Marsha, want to start us off?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, and Judge Gaitis. The Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You are our last oral argument on today's calendar. And this case is A21-0118, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Jeffrey Scott Hurst, Appellant. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for Appellant, you have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. And at the start of your principal arguments, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. It's Ms. Margolis. Is that the right pronunciation?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. I'm going to guess at Mr. Hajdukovic.
Very good, Your Honor.
All right. Good. I think we are ready for counsel for appellant.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michelle Margolis, counsel for appellant Jeffrey Scott Hurst. This case is about a 15-year-old who, by her own admission, strategically engaged in a web of lies claiming that she was a 19-year-old named Megan, creating a false persona, including photos of her fake child and multiple fake social media profiles, in order to induce 47-year-old Jeffrey Hurst into having sex with her. Today, we ask the court to reverse the lower court's decision, vacate Mr. Hurst's conviction, and remand to the district court for two main reasons. First, because the statute's ban on Mr. Hurst asserting a mistake of age defense violated his substantive due process rights as applied in this particular case. And second, because the district court erred in denying Mr. Hurst a downward durational departure at sentencing. The facts of this case are very different from the typical third-degree criminal sexual conduct case because of the magnitude of the victim's deception, as well as the total agreement of all witnesses that Mr. Hurst had no idea the victim was underage and was not who she purported to be. The appellant, Mr. Hurst, engaged in communication over social media with an individual purporting to be a 19-year-old named Megan Soller in September 2018.
We know that the facial challenge to the lack of a mistake of age defense failed, and you're arguing, well, okay, as applied here. What are the outer limits of that? Because every person who has a mistake, let's presume that their defense is that, in fact, they were mistaken. You're saying that, well, when the evidence comes in and it shows that, oh boy, they were mistaken for a really good reason because they were misled, as opposed to they were mistaken for some other reason or what is the standard by which then a verdict of guilt would be thrown out as a violation of constitutional rights as applied when two people are equally mistaken? Let's say two defendants are equally mistaken about age. What's
sure,
the standard?
Your Honor, I think that's a good question, but I think actually when you're doing an as-applied challenge, there really wouldn't be a standard that would apply over multiple different cases. I think you have to take each case individually. I understand Your Honor's concerns with regard to how do we move forward instead of dealing with every single defendant who comes in asking for this. But I think that you have to take it individually and look at the fact that this isn't the typical case where the facts in Holloway, I think, are very different. The facts in
Holloway, I understand that, but it's just, we need, even as an as-applied matter, if you're asking going forward, defendants have a right to this as-applied defense, there has to be some circumstance in which they have that right. And one thing you just said is, oh, it's not typical. There's evidence about the typicality of cases that comes in determine?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor. Since we don't have case law specifically on this that we can look at, perhaps one of the things that we can look at is what the Minnesota practice series suggests. And the Minnesota practice series suggests that quote, when a mistake of fact is not provided as a defense, or even when it is specifically excluded, due process would seem to permit a defendant to show that he was led to the mistaken belief by words or acts of others, especially if these are deliberately misleading. So if you're looking, if Your Honor is looking for a standard or a category of cases, my thought would be when the facts show that they weren't just misled, but they were very significantly and intentionally, deliberately misled by the claimant, as was the case here. More than just saying, hey, I'm 19. In this case, it was over multiple platforms, all corresponding with the same information, had her photograph on there. She faked a photo with a child that she purported to be her own child, and sent it to Mr. Hurst. She told him about the college she was in. You know, she had a whole life, a whole different persona that she then was able to continue with pre-planned lies that she told the police that she had planned out. She knew if they asked her why she didn't drive, she was going to say this. If they asked her why she didn't have an ID, she was going to say this. In order to maintain that lie and the appearance of being 19.
I'm sorry to interrupt, and this is kind of a far out question, and I know you didn't really present it in your briefing, but given the circumstances of this case, I mean, is this really a mistake of age defense, or is it something different that maybe isn't even contemplated by the plain language of the statute?
Your Honor, I think that I struggled with this because I struggled to figure out exactly what defenses fit the bill for this. And I think I think there is some larger kind of due process. I mean, if this had been state action, it certainly would have been entrapment, but you can't argue entrapment with non-state action. But I do think this still fits the bill for a mistake of age defense. I think that there is a potential for additional defenses or that this could be broader or could have more more implications. But I do think that this fits the bill for a mistake of age defense because no one, not even the police, questioned that he truly believed that she was 19 years old. Unlike the vast majority of cases that we see where the defendant claims that he didn't know, the vast majority of cases, the police will indicate, well, she looked like she was borderline age, she acted young, she dressed young, or her speech pattern was pretty obviously young. In this, the police make no indication of that. At no time in the record is any of that brought up. There is no one questioning his belief that she was truly 19. And she admitted to the police on multiple occasions that he had no reason to believe she was anything other than 19 because she maintained that throughout.
Ms. Margolis?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to kind of keep you along that track, perhaps a little bit, Ms. Margolis, that for our review, the Holloway Court did make it pretty clear as it relates to the fundamental right and said it was not because there's a long history in which mistake of age is not a defense. So that puts us in the rational basis analysis. So even as we apply these facts, doesn't that law still apply even in that part of our constitutional analysis? Because if, as the court clearly said there, that there's a long, the history does not suggest that that has ever been a warranted defense. I'm just using loose language now. Would that also therefore make it easier for the state's position in this case or for our review that as a result of that, a rational basis, and we know what the basis is as a facial challenge. I think no one disputes the protection from trafficking and so forth. Wouldn't that apply then also to this issue? If you understand my question, is that inherently he doesn't have that right to a defense. And even under these facts that might put him in a much more sympathetic light and probably outside the norm of what the legislature was thinking of when they created that 10-year gap, we're still left with a rational basis. And those the long length of cases would suggest that the perpetrator is charged with the knowledge of one's age and or imputed, essentially.
I understand what Your Honor is asking, and I think that's a good question. First, I just want to make sure, although we understand that your honors are bound by the Holloway Supreme Court decision that it's a rational basis test and not strict scrutiny, we still maintain that that is an incorrect decision. But here today, when you're in front of your honors, we do need to apply the rational basis test. But here, the rational basis test, you still have to apply it in an as-applied challenge. And there are a number of cases, including cases I cite in my brief, such as State v. Bussman, State v. Grossman, Olson, McDonald versus Commission of Public Safety, in which they say it is facially valid. But when you apply the same standard as applied in this case, you have to submit the, you have to apply the rational basis test again in this case. It wasn't valid as applied. In this case, where Mr. Hurst was very intentionally, effectively, and strategically duped by SJS into believing that she was 19 years old, the purpose of having the rational basis reasoning goes out the window. It breaks down entirely because Mr. Hurst had no intent to have sex with a minor. He had was not even reckless in doing so. He did his due diligence in learning more about her. He talked with her. He got to know her on social media for a while prior to meeting her in person, during which time they discussed her age, where she went to college, her child, and other details of her life. And prior to even meeting her in person, he conducted due diligence to find out more about her. Now, when
if I could jump in here, and I certainly think we understand the factual circumstances here, just as sort of a side note, but I want to talk about the Moser case, which you relied on to some extent in your brief. And I'm just wondering, and maybe the person I should be asking this question to, and maybe I will, hint, hint, is Mr. Hajdukovic. How can we harmonize Moser and Holloway?
I think that the way in which we harmonize them, Your Honor, because we can't, Your Honor certainly can't change the decision in Holloway. But I think that the only way in which we harmonize is by allowing individuals like Mr. Hurst to be able to, when they have situations like this, be able to have a non-strict scrutiny defense, essentially, being able to assert the mistake of age defense, because there has to be a knowing element when someone is entirely duped and when everyone agrees someone is entirely duped. And the Moser case,
Let me ask you this. Moser relies on the United States Supreme Court's decision in the Staples case, which, you know, essentially says you can't have a strict liability felony offense. And I noticed that you didn't really pursue that argument to this this court, that this is essentially a strict liability offense, and you come at the due process argument from that angle. Is there a reason for that? Do you contend that this is a strict liability offense, kind of like the offense in Moser was?
We believe that this is a strict liability offense, but we raised this issue because we didn't raise the issue as it is here because we thought that simply attacking the strict liability would have been already decided by Holloway. And we didn't want to raise issues that had already been decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court and waste this court's time, essentially. But that's why we did the as applied. But I agree with you that this is essentially a strict liability case. I believe that you know, that as you indicate, there is a general criminal common law principle that there has to be a mens rea element, some sort of knowing element. And when you have someone who's innocent at heart, someone who committed an offense because he actually did have sex with someone who is under the age of 16, and even though everyone agrees he didn't know, there's a problem there. We have a problem, and it's uncomfortable for everyone involved. We actually had a district court judge opt out because he didn't want to hear these issues, because he heard the fourth defendant essentially in line who was charged with this same complainant. And this is a challenging issue because it just makes everyone uncomfortable. Your Honor, and I think because so many people have that gut feeling of uncomfortableness that this is a strict liability, this is a major, serious felony involving predatory offender registration, prison time, and you don't have a mens rea. This is strict liability. I don't think that is appropriate. I think that the only way in which right now under current case law that we could remedy that is allow for an as-applied challenge and application in certain individual cases with the mistake of age defense, unless the legislature changes it.
Thank you very much for your argument. Counsel for respond.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovich. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney. I represent respondent state of Minnesota. This court should affirm appellant's conviction as well as his sentence. Judge Freeman correctly concluded that the Holloway case controls here regarding the constitutional issue raised by appellant. And Judge Freeman also did not abuse her very broad discretion by imposing a presumptive sentence under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. Now, I want to move to the constitutional issue, and I want to answer Judge Gaitis's question about harmonizing Moser and Holloway. But before I get into that legal analysis, I just want to dispute one piece of the framing of the issue by Ms. Margolis. From the state's position, this isn't just a case about a 15-year-old who lied. It's also a case about a man who has multiple sex-related offense convictions, who was given the tools to deal with situations like this and failed to do so. Let me just
interrupt you there, because none of that was appropriately before the court in the fact-finding stage, at least, right? I mean, there was no Spriegel evidence here, was there?
No, I agree with that. And that's not part of the legal analysis here, but it's just in terms of a feeling sympathy for the defendant. I think it's important to note both sides of that issue. Since Ms. Margolis emphasized that, I wanted to point out the counterpoint. But I agree, from a legal perspective, at least as to the constitutional issue, I don't think it matters. Now, moving to that question of harmonizing Moser and Holloway, I think they can actually be easily harmonized, because the Moser court was very plain in distinguishing the electronic solicitation statute that was at issue there from the statutory rape provisions of the criminal sexual conduct statutes. What this court in Moser said was that, or how it distinguished the problem of a mistake of age defense not being in that statute from the criminal sexual conduct law, was that a person who violates the electronic solicitation statute at the time did not have to have, there essentially didn't have to be any knowledge, not only no knowledge that the person was a child, but also never meeting the person in child in person, or who the person on the other end essentially in person. And what this court stated is, and I quote, a defendant can reasonably be required to ascertain the age of a person the defendant meets in person. That's how this court differentiated that statute from the criminal sexual conduct laws on statutory rape. And frankly, I think that language is controlling here. I think it allows us to harmonize the Holloway decision from Moser, but not only does it allow us to do that, but it provides us with a clear principle here that a person can reasonably be required to ascertain the age of a person who they meet in person, as opposed to online, who they may never even see a photo of potentially, and there'd be absolutely no way for them to ever know if that person was telling the truth or not, or even sometimes even have an inkling. So I think that's how those two can be dealt with. And then I also want to answer the next question you asked, Your Honor, about strict liability. The Holloway case, I think, answers the strict liability question. Part three, the final part of the Holloway opinion, talks about strict liability because Holloway made a challenge that it was unconstitutional because it imposed strict liability. And the Holloway court said, no, it doesn't actually impose strict liability because the statute is a general intent statute in terms of the person has to intend to engage in sexual penetration or sexual contact, depending on the specific statute.
Mr. Hajdukovich, on that issue, isn't that at least part of, and I'm surmising part of Judge Gaetis' question seems a bit in stark contrast to the U.S. Supreme Court decision, the Staples decision. The analysis in Moser was focusing on the element of age and the lack of a mistake of age defense, whereas in Holloway, the court just talked about general intent. And I don't know here, perhaps nor there, but at least not here, that that's really a question that's being raised, but specifically the fact that a defense is otherwise lost and it's not an element otherwise other than the concession, because no one's disputing here factually that she was below, she was 15. And so doesn't that, as Moser was explaining and from the U.S. Supreme Court's analysis, at least suggest that's a strict liability element, which is disfavored?
Well, I what I would say in response to that is, and again, obviously, counsel didn't raise strict liability, so this is getting a little bit of field, but it may not be completely irrelevant to the analysis, that I think strict liability crimes are disfavored. But what the Supreme, what our Supreme Court seems to be saying in Holloway is that we don't look at just the specific elements to look at strict liability. We look at the crime as a whole, all the elements. If they're, and I think that's consistent with a lot of other cases. I didn't look at those in preparation for today, but where we talk about whether a crime is a strict liability crime, typically I think the analysis is looking at the crime as a whole, not a specific element. So
and maybe I think you're leading into my follow-up question. It does seem indeed, if we presume, I mean, looking at Holloway, that it was a facial challenge, and you could tell that the alternate arguments were dispensed with by the court, including the strict liability as a whole. But now, if we are looking at a as applied, and we look at our facts, and we look at a otherwise strict liability, I'll just call it type of an element, does that play a role into then our analysis as to whether by these facts, very specific facts, there is a rational basis for that 10-year limitation, in other words, excluding that mistake of defense to this defendant?
I think it would be really hard to say that, given the fact that we're dealing with the same statute as the Holloway court was, so we're talking about exactly the same statutory language, I think it would be really, really hard to tease out a difference in terms of the strict liability, or if we want to call it that, mattering in the one context versus another context, or playing any significant role, because the Supreme Court basically said in Holloway that the legislature made a reasoned and rational decision to sort of do this blanket ban on asserting this defense. And we can look at it from a rational basis perspective on individual facts, I suppose. But I don't.
Isn't that what's being requested here? In other words, the Holloway court did not at any time in its analysis in section 1B, I believe it was, when talking about what the rational basis was, talk about the facts of that case. Isn't that a prototypical facial analysis?
Correct. I would agree. And ultimately, I wish that the court had been a little clearer in Holloway about the precise type of analysis it was doing, but it also, I don't think, ultimately matters in our case. Since Ms. Margolis has conceded that we are in rational basis review in this particular case, I'll just address that. And the statute must only provide a reasonable means to a permissible objective. And what the Supreme Court said in Holloway is that it is not irrational for the legislature to provide a mistake of age for only some, but not all adults. And I think that's just really hard language for the appellant to get around in this case. Simply put, as the court indicated, a reasonable way to deter or sanction this conduct and thereby protect children is to preclude a mistake of age defense for certain adults. It is essentially to impose a blanket ban on the defense.
What is that? I realize you're not the legislature, but what is the rationale? I mean, is it that because you're 10 years older, you should know better? Is it that you're 10 years older, you're better at assessing age? What is the point of the statute?
I think there's probably, just surmising myself here, that there are, I can think of two, and that's one of them, that as you grow older, you get more mature and you should be better about recognizing that. I think the other one might be that potentially, and again, this is just me surmising, that it might be seen as a situation where it might be more harmful to children to be abused by some adult who's that much older than them in terms of, you know, maybe compromising their ability to trust people, things like that. Whereas a younger person, not that it still obviously is harmful. I'm not trying to say it's not harmful, but that there may be some sort of qualitative difference there as well, that where if there's a mistake of age, we might be willing to give them some leniency, I guess, in that instance.
Let me follow up with that, Mr. Hadakovich. You continue to be a mini legislature then. In Holloway, the court made references to U.S. Supreme Court decisions that the prevention of sexual exploitation and abuse of children constitutes a government objective of surpassing importance. And the government has a compelling interest in protecting even children who lie about their age, referring to the Gilgert case, protecting children from self-destructive decisions, and also protecting children from sexual abuse and exploitation. So no one's really disputing all of those. My question to you is, what by these specific facts would suggest that appellant, that basis is met, given the overt and the steps taken by this individual? To say another way, would I be comfortable and safe in saying that this was not the prototypical child the legislature had in mind when they structured that 10-year statutory language?
You know, I don't know. It's actually kind of hard for me to say what they had in mind. And this bleeds into the analysis a little bit in the sentencing issue in terms of what is a typical case of this type. And Judge Freeman, at the time of sentencing, was an experienced prosecutor before she took the bench, indicated that she didn't find this to be that a particularly atypical case. In fact, what was atypical about it was how much older the defendant was than the complainant in the case. And the appellant hasn't provided any information to dispute that. So I what Judge Freeman observed, and I think this was in the sentencing context, but I think it's apt here as well, is that teenagers in particular lie about their age for a variety of reasons, everything from wanting to get into a bar when they're underage to sometimes wanting to have sexual encounters with older people. And that's, you know, probably a product of their development or lack of development in terms of maturity. We've all heard about the data about brains not being fully developed until around the age of 25. And so I think there's a rational basis. And again, I may have to take back something I said earlier about the appellant's prior convictions not being part of the analysis here. I agree it wasn't part of the factual findings in terms of the findings of guilt because it wasn't relevant to that. But the fact is that if we're looking for a rational basis to apply it here, the appellant is someone who has been in trouble with the law for sex-related offenses, dealing with boundaries, according to the PSI, was given the tools he needed.
That raises a good point. So wouldn't that therefore be something though that a jury, so for instance, if he decided to testify, in impeachment evidence or some of that would have come in, but the point being he never did get the mistake of age. In other words, jury could have said, well, we don't buy it because of some other factors that might've been relevant under the rules of evidence. But the point being here is it just never got he never was allowed that. So now that we're at this stage, then it would be completely irrelevant, I assume.
Well, it's irrelevant in terms of the facts, but it's not in terms of what happened in this case. It may not be irrelevant in a rational basis determination of if we're essentially looking at, is there a rational reason to apply this law in this type of situation? then I think we have to take everything into account that's in the record, not just the facts that were found by Judge Freeman, because, you know, what was put into the record in front of Judge Freeman for her to make her factual findings from was what's relevant to the elements of the crime, without any dispute about the age and the fact that under the law, he couldn't dispute, you know, make any mistake of age claim, since that Judge Freeman had already decided that. So that's why, that's where I think it's relevant. I don't want to get too caught up in that particular issue, but again, I just don't want us to lose sight of it. If we're looking at this from a perspective of, is there any reason in particular to apply the law to this defendant? I think we shouldn't lose sight of that history. That's my only point. And frankly, I think this gets into where what Ms. Margolis suggested for a standard was intentional deception, of when there's no rational basis to apply, essentially, for the legislature to have criminalized the conduct. And I disagree with that because, again, going back to what Judge Freeman said, that is fairly typical in this type of case. And so the legislature would be ignoring a typical type of case and essentially ignoring that when criminalizing it. And I don't think we can assume that, especially under the deferential rational basis review. Simply put, in deception, which I think generally speaking is by its nature intentional, is part of what teenagers do. And we're the statute, the purpose again is to protect, obviously protecting children who the law has decided, frankly, don't know enough to make these types of really important decisions by themselves. And this is how the legislature has decided. The Holloway court said that was rational, and there's really nothing about this case that differentiates it from Holloway. Given that, I would ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
First, with regard to counsel's statements regarding Mosier and indicating that the takeaway is reasonably, that the defendant should be reasonably required to ascertain the age of the victim if they're in person with them. Well, that's different than in this case, because not only was there the intentional deception, but also Mr. Hurst did due diligence. And I think that's really the standard that should be applied when doing an as-applied challenge for the mistake of age defense, not just the intentional deception and the vast intentional deception here in this case, but also on the part of the defendant, if he's doing due diligence, this is a case where he's actually talking to her, he's finding things out, he's not just meeting her and then 5 seconds later having sex with her without really asking any questions about her, not really knowing anything and ignoring what, like in Holloway, ignoring the fact that he went in the middle of the night to the victim's house and had sex in the victim's bed while the mom was in the house. I mean, the facts in that case are so different. I think the district court here was wrong. Yeah, the district court did say that they thought this case was the typical case. I submit that's incorrect. It is not the typical case. The extent of the manipulation, the extent of the lies, and the extent of the conversations that Mr. Hurst had with SJS prior to meeting in person and prior to having sex, and the fact that even after they met, he introduced her to his friends. They went out in public. She continued the lies. No one questioned her age. That is different. This is not the typical case. And when you have a case in which there's a massive amount of intentional deception and lying about the age on the part of the complainant and due diligence on the part of the defendant, I think that is a reasonable standard to have to start really looking at whether the mistake of age defense should be applied as it should have been here. And I think Your Honor was correct when you asked, shouldn't this have been put to the jury? Should, you know, there are a lot of questions here where maybe the jury wouldn't have bought it. Maybe the jury would have said, I still think that you're guilty. I still think that you should have known. But he should have been able to submit that to the jury. That is fundamental fairness with regard to presenting a meaningful defense. And that's where we have the problem with Mosier also. Mosier, I think the Court of Appeals was correct in applying the strict scrutiny standard. I think that there was a fundamental right, and I think the same fundamental right exists here in this case. Unfortunately, I think we are somewhat bound. I would be thrilled if the court decided that we weren't bound by the State v. Holloway's decision to apply rational basis. But unfortunately, I think we may be. However, I think that the Minnesota Supreme Court should be reevaluating that. I don't think that it should be rational basis. But even if we apply rational basis, it's important to note that the rational basis breaks down in this case. What about this case? How could children have been protected by not allowing him a mistake of age defense? How could this conduct have been deterred by not allowing a mistake of age defense to be put to a jury? We're not saying automatically find him not guilty, but in a case like this, there is nothing that would have, there's no way that this ban on applying the mistake of age defense for people who are 10 years older or more, how this would have deterred conduct where everyone agrees he didn't know and where he did his due diligence. It's not a deterrent. It certainly doesn't protect the child. And we know that SJS continued to, she wasn't protected. She continued to do this time after time. She continued to refine her lies, the lies that you can see in the district court record. We have the complaints of each of the cases. The level of deception increases with each defendant. And in Mr. Hurst's case is far more extensive than it is in the previous ones. She learned from the previous cases. I think she, the deception and the due diligence was far greater in this case. And I think that the mistake of age defense should apply. And therefore, we respectfully request that the court reverse the lower court's holding and remand. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments today. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. And now I